chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them.
But we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing. As the great political philosopher and novelist George Orwell once wrote, the past was alterable. The past never had been altered. Aldovia was at war with Panglia. Panglia had always been at war with Aldovia. Hey, Eliza.
Hey, Janelle. Janelle, there is no war in East Panglia.
There is no war in East Panglia. There is no Christmas war in Belgravia. All is well.
We've never been at war with East Panglia. We've always been at war with... Yeah, no, there's definitely, like... These movies are fucking weird.
I just feel like I did not expect that our conversation about this particular movie was going to revolve around alternate histories, memories of war, political sabotage, and the long memories of conquest. But here we are. And that is what we're going to be talking about today.
With a small dose of identity politics and terrible relationship advice peppered in.
Gotta have it. It's not the Netflix Christmas cinematic universe without objectively terrible relationship advice.
Right. Just like everyone can agree, the worst relationship advice. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in case you haven't caught on, we are today talking about the final, Dear God We Hope, installment of the Christmas Prince saga, the Christmas Prince royal baby.
End it. End it now.
Janelle, we've reached the end. 3 Christmas months and we're finally reaching the end of this monstrosity.
I honestly don't think I ever believed we would make it to this point. But I guess, you know, given that these movies have followed the trajectory pretty much to the letter of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry's relationship, I'm assuming the next movie we're going to see in 2021 is A Christmas Prince, the Royal Fracture.
A Christmas Prexit. You know, it's interesting, though, because if we're viewing this as a trilogy, much like a lot of, like, young adult novel trilogies, I would say that here in the third installment, where you would think we would just get the end story to all the setup we've had in the first two, they add a lot of new lore.
So much new lore? I mean, under the guise that our lead character is learning about the history of the country she now leads, which, like, fair enough, writers, that's actually a pretty good move. But why?
It's a very Hunger Games style, like, okay, we've had two movies that have been very sort of consistent structurally, and now our third installment is just, like, a whole new fucking thing.
Yeah, just yes, it's Christmas, but more importantly, it's a whodunit. It's a curse. It's a fairy tale.
Right.
It's a political intrigue.
We've just accepted that magic exists in this world. We had one line in which you as a viewer either accept it or turn the TV off. Those are your only two options.
Yeah, they are really not doing well convincing us that they're not the totalitarian dictatorships of Christmas. So, you know, thanks a lot, Netflix.
Well, I guess before we go any further, we should summarize this movie. For those who are intelligent enough to not watch it.
As per usual, friends, here is your Google summary for A Christmas Prince, The Royal Baby, The Year of Our Lord, 2019. The, as always, Google summary for Netflix movies reads, Queen Amber, played by Rose McIver, and King Richard, played by Ben Lamb, host royals from a faraway kingdom called Panglia to renew a sacred truce. But when the priceless treaty disappears, peace is put in jeopardy, and an ancient curse threatens the family. So, Eliza, on that note, that's what Google says this movie's about. But, like, what's it really about?
Well, see, here's the thing, Janelle, is that the movie starts the way you expect it to, right? Like, it starts with Amber still writing on her blog, as queens do, and needlessly summarizing what she's been up to for the past year, which is sort of what you expect. Okay, we're going to get, like, a couple scenes of exposition, even though she's writing to her loyal listeners. So, like, theoretically, they should already know this because they've been paying attention. But she's, you know, she's become queen. She has adopted a fully Kate Middleton wardrobe like 100% the first two scenes. I swear they just went onto one of those like articles that's like, here's everything Kate Middleton has worn to her last three appearances, and then just like bought those copy outfits from Kohl's and put them on Amber. Surprise, she's pregnant, so there's a new baby on the way, so there's lots of shots of her like holding her belly, holding it so hard it looks like she's trying to hold the fake belly to her body because it's been jiggling. Like, it's so funny. And, you know, and she's been learning more about the country and struggling a little bit with her duties, but like she thinks it's going well. Okay, great, we're following this, we're following this. Then they're like, and now we're gonna throw a bunch of war history at you, and a whole complicated, makes absolutely no sense thing about a 500-year-old treaty that we ceremonially re-sign every 100 years, except apparently if we don't re-sign it, a bunch of economic treatises are also gonna no longer be in effect, which makes very little sense, because I doubt in 1491 or whatever the hell it was, they actually wrote in economic and trade sanctions that would make sense in this, the year of our Lord 2019. But apparently they're all wrapped up into this ancient illuminated manuscript scroll. So that's a thing that's happening. And then they add a weird clue style, we've got to keep everyone in the castle who done it on top of that. So I think that the writers got two scenes in writing on the same structure they'd done the first two movies on, and then we're like, we're out of ideas, fuck it, and just like opened up an entirely new playbook.
Yeah, I think my favorite turn of this, where you can really see the writers doing exactly what you're talking about, Eliza, is that all of those things happen. And then they remember, oh, wait, this plot is supposed to revolve around a baby. The name of this movie is The Christmas Prince, A Royal Baby. How do we involve the baby in this plot? Oh, I know. An ancient curse.
That will befall the baby.
I don't even remember. What are the consequences for the curse? Is it just going to, like, kill their baby?
They continually say the firstborn will be cursed. There's no description of what that means. Like, we don't know if, like, he's going to have a pigtail or never be able to have children or will, like, lead the country into ruin. It's very unclear. But my favorite thing is that the princess, whose name I can never remember, is reading a history book about the 500 years ago signing of this document that basically just said these two countries are no longer going to be at war. And then she's like, oh, this history book says that then they had it, you know, blessed or cursed or whatever by like a sorceress who said that if it didn't get re-signed in 100 years, then whichever country didn't sign it will have a curse put on them. And she says this to her mother, the Dowager Queen, and to the, like, you know, Grand Steward or whatever he is. And he goes, sorcery fell out of favor centuries ago. What does that mean? Fell out of favor? He doesn't say people stopped believing in magic. He says sorcery fell out of favor. Like, it's not popular anymore, so it probably won't do anything.
Right. Like, I love that they didn't just commit to, like, we live in a world where the religion is... See, I remember when we talked about the royal wedding. And I remember saying that what I found kind of interesting about that movie was that it really showed us that the state religion of Aldovia is not actually Christianity, as you might expect, what with it being a Christmas movie, but rather Christmas itself is the religion. Mm-hmm. Because they have their whole weird Christmas nativity play with the Christmas Shrek, right, or whatever. So why didn't they just lean into, like, oh no, they signed this thing at Christmas and some Christmas magic. Someone didn't want to celebrate Christmas properly, so some Christmas magic had to happen. And because you didn't celebrate Christmas, your baby turns into a Grinch. Like, why didn't they just lean into that? That could have been fun.
I genuinely think I would have liked that better, because as we've talked about with a lot of these movies, the sort of secret sauce behind them is this understanding of the magic of Christmas, right? Like, that at Christmas, yeah, miracles can happen. At Christmas, family come out of the woodwork and help you save your farm, you know, whatever the hell it is. And I feel like this series has, like, lost the Christmas magic as it's gone on. Not that it had it well established from the beginning, because it's just whole concept of how that works is been odd, but it at least sort of has been kind of in the background, like, but it's Christmas, and so maybe we'll all forgive each other or whatever. And this was more like, oh no, if something goes wrong at Christmas, then we'll all die, which is so much more dire.
Which is true.
But yeah, it wasn't this kind of like, oh, well, and as you know, the miracle happened because of Christmas. It was just like, it happened on Christmas Day. That's just a historical fact. And now we have to deal with this. Weirdly, though, I did note there's a couple different times where either the group is singing or they're walking by carolers or whatever. And all of the Christmas carols that appeared in this movie are very explicitly hymns. They were very explicitly religious Christmas songs. I don't exactly remember what they were because we've watched too many of these now. But it was like Hark the Herald or Angels We Have Heard on High. Like, they were like songs you sing in church on Christmas type songs rather than like Winter Wonderland. And I thought that that was an interesting choice, that like three times in a row they played like very specifically Christian songs when they've been sort of skirting around it up till now. So this movie both had like more of the like specifically Christmas elements and also less of the Christmas magic.
Okay, and here's another thing that's related to that that I think is so interesting, Eliza, is like, yes, they lost the Christmas magic, and yes, they seem to be leaning more into this Christianity thing. And then they make this very particular choice to racialize the kingdom of Panglia as East or Central Asian in some way. I mean, you have the king is Thai, the queen is Ming. I believe that these are Chinese names, more or less, is my understanding. But the way that the character in the flashback to the original treaty signing is stylized, he looks very Mongol. He looks like the kind of representations of Genghis Khan. Now, as we have seen from the greatest map ever made in history, the map that shows us Eldovia, Belgravia, and Panglia, it is not inconceivable that Panglia is like a leftover from the old Mongol Empire that somehow it like held out through the 15th century to today, which is like pretty impressive. But then these characters celebrate Christmas, even though the Mongol Empire was invariably a lot of different religions, but not particularly Christian. I mean, they practice shamanism, Buddhism, Islam. There was a lot of variation in religion. And then also the children of the monarchs, Ming and Tai, have these very anglicized, very British even names like Edith. So you have to wonder, did Eldovia colonize Panglia and we're just like not supposed to talk about it? And like they're like using their Christmas dictatorship to like force the Panglian monarchs to play this dumbass Christmas tree decorating board game against their will? Like what is the subtext of these politics?
It's
what is
going so odd. On? Also, we're going to get back to that Christmas tree board game. But yeah, no, for those, again, who didn't stop and intensely study the map, as Janelle and I did, Panglia, this country that they say are their closest allies and their closest neighbors and whatever, appears to exist on a piece of land that in our universe does not exist, that has been superimposed over the majority of the Black Sea. So it appears to be directly above Turkey, in an area that, again, in our universe is water. And Eldovia appears to have taken over a number of Eastern European Slavic countries, such as Bosnia-Herzegovina, Croatia, that sort of thing. And then Belgravia seems to be a little north and a little east of that over, you think, like, Romania. And so they're definitely, we're in an area that, again, by our history, was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, like definitely saw a heavy growth of Eastern Orthodox Christianity, but with a lot of influences from the Islamic cultures coming up through Turkey, and also some influences, obviously, from ancient Roman and ancient Greek explorers and conquerors as well. But then we've got this country that's right next to them, that's right in sort of the Turkey-ish area, that, again, we see 500 years ago seems to have a Genghis Khan-like Mongol ruler, and today has very light-skinned, East Asian-coded rulers, but seems to follow the same Christian cultural and and religious practices as these European nations. So I feel like there's some really complex history of Panglia that they did not get into that I would be fascinated to deep dive into.
Yes, I want to know how the great Mongol Empire could have hung on in that like Black Sea, Ukraine, kind of Slavic area, and like, what are they, like Eastern Orthodox? Are they Russian Orthodox? Are they Ukrainian Orthodox? Like, I'm so curious. And how did that happen? How did the Mongols not just go like, no, we don't want that? Like, what is the history of that? And also, what role did Aldovia have in that? So many questions. Well, and
clearly Aldovia had a role in it because they've had a peaceful relationship, quote unquote, with the Panglians for 500 years after a warring relationship for however long before that. So like, what sort of
600 cultural, years, right?
600 years. Yeah, you're right. So like, what sort of cultural influences, for better and for worse, have been happening between these two countries? Because clearly Aldovia does not seem to have taken on any sort of Eastern or Middle Eastern cultural elements. Like, they are coded not only European, but Western European, really.
Yeah, and like, they're the manuscript itself, or not the manuscript, rather, the treaty itself is also really interesting in that regard, because as Eliza noted, it is a pretty slamming, like, illuminated medieval manuscript, which is like pretty gorgeous. I loved that. And Sahil talking smack about that illuminated manuscript made me very sad. I was like, excuse me, it is not tacky. It is classy and elegant, and it is full of sex imagery.
The one time I supported Amber, she was like, this is a priceless piece of art. And I was like, yes, Amber.
Tell him, because that thing is gorgeous. But however, it is really interesting because when you watch them sign it, the monarch of Aldovia, or the leader of the Aldovian army, rather, is signing the treaty in sort of, you know, your standard left to right Roman script, yeah? Mm-hmm. But then the Panglian leader is writing in a sort of top to bottom script that looks very similar to Mongol, and even possibly to, like, simplified Chinese. So it's very interesting that the treaty itself is very much a representation of like a very clearly European, and specifically kind of like a Western European even tradition, mm-hmm. which is why it's interesting that they clearly code Aldovia as being like in the region of Slavic influence, of certainly, you know, like you said, Eurasian kind of situations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like the what I'm trying to get at is that the treaty itself is sort of a symbol of this like European cultural dominance here, even though this is supposed to be an even-handed treaty. It's clearly not.
Janelle, can I just say, when the four of them, because the two kings and the two queens, signed the treaty, I had to pause because I couldn't stop laughing. Because what? The whole thing is so awkward. So yeah, the Panglian king, he does seem to be signing in some form of Asian script, but it also is clearly not, like, he's not writing in an actual Asian language, because he stumbles as he's doing it, and then it just kind of looks like scribbles. And I think that they, like, gave him a thing he was supposed to write in, and he, like, practiced it once and then had to do it on camera, because you can tell he's, like, really not prepared for it. And then his queen, who just writes, like, a cursive name, also stumbles and, like, fucks it up, and then it just becomes a scribble. Like, she, like, started to sign her, like, the actress's actual name and then realized she shouldn't and, like, fucked it up. Then Amber writes in non-cursive an A, an M, and then just scribbles. And then the guy who plays the Aldovian king, I think, just straight up signed his name, because he's the only one who did it like in one swoop, as if he was practiced at it. And I just was like so overcome with laughing at how awkward all of those signatures were. Like, if you can stand to do it, go back and just watch that like 1 minute of footage, because it's so clearly fucked up and weird.
I would love to watch how these Netflix movies are made, because I swear, I think we talked about this with The Princess Switch, but I'm like 85% of the way there to believing that they literally do all of this in one take. Like, they're like, we got the take. We got the take. We got the take. Like, you just have to get the lines right and nothing else matters. Nothing.
I think you're right. And that certainly explains so much of the acting, because it's all so stilted. And so it's just, all right, let's talk for a second about the love story that happens in this movie.
Okay. First of all, I was really proud of my notes for this movie because I got a lot of good zingers in here that no one's ever going to hear but me. But I think my favorite one is, I'm looking at it right now. Why is Simon nice now? I hate it. Why do I care?
My last note in the notes that I took says, Simon, you're too good for her.
You think so?
Well, okay, so Simon's girlfriend, who is Amber's best friend from home, shows up unexpectedly at Christmas, and Amber is horrified and disgusted to see her best friend, so A plus friendship goals. And she's like, I can't believe she's spending Christmas with Simon's family. That's such a huge step. Except that Simon's family is her and her husband and her husband's family. So this would be like if your best friend started dating your cousin who you didn't like and then came to your house for Christmas. And you were like, spending time with his family is like a big step when you don't know them well. Except that it's your house. So like, no logic there. Then she says to her, she's like, Mel, I had no idea you two were so serious in your relationship. And Mel was like, we've been dating for a year. And I was like, yeah, I'm with Mel on this. Like, what did you think was happening? They've been dating for a year.
Yeah, Amber's whole approach to most things in this movie, I feel like just feels like so all over the place. Like that whole thing doesn't make sense. Her relationship with Queen Ming doesn't really make a lot of sense, to be honest. Like, how, like, weird she is about, like, don't you love that I'm a quirky American girl? And Queen Ming is like, not exactly. Like, I'm trying to figure you out. And the Amber's like, oh, you must be terrible. You must be one of these terrible royals that I don't like.
And then they keep telling us that Queen Ming is, like, super conservative and, like, doesn't approve of Amber and blah, blah, blah. Except the two of them actually get along the whole movie.
Yeah, so they never have any kind of meaningful conflict. It's so weird.
All of the conflicts are so strange. Going back to the relationship with Simon and Mel, she suspects that he's plotting against the country and cheating on her. And then 4 minutes, not even, after she finds out that she was mistaken about both of those things, he proposes and she's like, yes, of course.
Yeah, like none of it mattered.
And I was like, if I were him, I would not want to propose in this moment. Be like, oh, you fully believed that I was committing treason against my country and my family, and I was sleeping with my ex-girlfriend behind your back in the house that we're both sleeping in. But yeah, marry me. I trust you. And then she's like, yes, of course, I love you. And I was like, minutes ago, you were pretending to still date him so you could get information so that you could lock him in a jail cell.
Yeah. Well, and also her whole jealousy with the attaché for the Pangolians, Lin. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, like, I believe Simon, but do I? Like, they definitely were flirting the whole time. You saw it.
Oh, for sure.
I saw it.
No, Simon and Mel should not be getting married. I think we're agreed on that. They just, I think, halfway through writing this, we're like, oh, shit, we need a romance. And then going back to that relationship with Amber and the Queen, you know, there was two things happening here that made me very uncomfortable. One of which was just, like, there was the obvious racism of, oh, these white people taught the Asian people how to be modern and cool. Thank God. Go fuck yourself. But there was also this weird thing where the story they keep telling us is that Amber has been embraced by the people of Aldovia. And they love her and they adore her. And when she goes walking through the streets, they all want to talk to her and give her flowers. And they appreciate her modernization initiative and blah, 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 blah. And Queen Ming, who it is established does a lot of the work for the royal family in their own country. She, like, handles a lot of the financial things. She looks over the papers. She makes decisions for her husband. But he's the figurehead. And she's worried that people would not accept a woman being in that much power. And then the king continually is like, no, but the people of our country love her. And then in the end, she's like, maybe I can take credit for the work I've been doing. And I just was so confused about the messaging there, because I know from my own personal studies into monarchical history that the problem with female rulers is normally that the people love and adore them and want them to stay on and take power, and they're just not ready to claim credit. Wait. I might be off on that. That might not actually be how female history works. Like, what the fuck? That was their argument, was like, no, everyone loves her and the king wants her to take all the power and everyone's ready to modernize except this woman. But the only reason she's not ready to modernize is because she thinks no one wants her to modernize. Except they do. So in the end, she does. What?
I feel like this is a really good example of how the mentality of the hashtag girl boss has been sold back to us in both overt and subtle ways. It reminds me a lot, in some ways, of that show Undercover Boss, where they'll show these CEOs who roll up into their own businesses and go, what? My employees want to have better pay? They want vacation time? Well, if I had known that, I would have simply given it to them. Which is like very, it's a sort of similar mentality here, which is, oh, if I knew that people wanted me to be successful, I would be more open about how like forthright and intelligent I am. But now that you're telling me that people want me to be like that, I guess I'll be honest about that. Which is one, totally underselling how ungenerous, let us say, monarchs tend to be with their subjects, actually. And then two, it is also deeply underselling that, no, chickadees, the problem is not that ambitious women need to be more, open and vocal about their success, but rather that people need to be less caring about what's between someone's legs when they do something important. You know what I mean?
Well, just as you say that monarchs are more sort of ungenerous with their subjects, that goes the other way too. Historically, women in power, the people, whether that's their subjects or their employees or the general populace who's, you know, reading the paper every day and tweeting about them, whatever, tend to be pretty ungenerous with their acceptance of women in power, right? Correct. Like when women in power show that they are forthright and strong and capable, even when that does result in economic success, in a country doing well, in a business doing well, whatever, there is more negative press and negative attention than positive, right? Like Marie Antoinette was hated more by the people of France than her husband, who was the actual one ruling the country where no one had food to eat. But she was a woman, so she was labeled a whore, and she was accused of ensnaring him and entrapping him and leading him down the path of pornography and lasciviousness and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It was all her fault, right? And this still happens. People are like, I can't believe that Meghan Markle convinced Harry to leave the monarchy. And to all of them, I want to be like, why do you think he married her? Right? Like, this is the same problem. And so the idea that, like, this queen really, her country will love to know that she has appeared and decided to take over and rule instead of the king and do all of these modernization, ideas. But her conservative country, they'll love that because they'll be so impressed with her initiative. It's like, yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah. And also, like, that's not what people like about Amber, too. Let's be very clear.
Right.
Amber's ambition and political acumen is not what makes her beloved in the fucking streets.
No, she's
okay?
Kate Middleton, right? Like, they like her because she's pretty and she's nice and she had a baby and she dresses cute and she supports her husband, right? Like, they're not like, oh my God, thank God we have this genius, political savvy American here. They like her because she's interesting. She's, you know, culturally popular. She's famous, not a professional.
Well, and I think the comparison that you're making between Queen Ming and Meghan Markle is a particularly astute one, in part because both of their identities play so much into how they're perceived in ways that people want to just throw under the rug, right? Like Queen Ming, the way people talk about her before she arrives on the scene in the movie is she's cold, she's formal, she's not fun. And all of these are descriptions that are levied against the stereotype of the quote-unquote dragon lady, right? Mm-hmm. Which is the kind of prevailing Western stereotype of Asian women, East Asian women specifically, right? And so then when we do get Queen Ming, and she is, like, very astute and organized and formal and committed to the sort of legacy of her royal line, which I would like to know more about, because apparently she comes from a properly royal line from somewhere. Who? Where? Doesn't matter. I wish that the film, instead of saying like, wow, you know what, if Queen Ming would just lighten up a little bit and talk a little bit more about herself like an American, she'd be great. And instead they could have just said like, no, you know what, Queen Ming is great already. Like, she knows what she's about. She knows her position in the society in which she traffics, and we're not going to judge her for understanding her own cultural context in a savvy way, right? It reminds me a lot of some of Michelle Yeoh's speeches in Crazy Rich Asians. They're just so magnificent. The speech that she gives about our children leave home and then they forget who they are. It's a good reminder that Americans specifically, but white Westerners in general, love to assume that we know better and we know best about how to operate in the world in a way that is free and progressive. And we don't. We know how that works kind of in our own cultural context, but we have no space to tell someone like Queen Ming, no. I know how to make your people love you because I understand them better than you do.
Well, and while we're talking about that, I'd like to pivot a little bit to the sort of the odd homegrown identity politics that are happening in this movie, which I think are not inconsistent with what we've seen in the earlier Christmas Prince movies and in all of these sort of Hallmark-esque Christmas movies that we've been watching, but they really double down on it here where everyone is so defined by the culture that they came from. You know, like when Amber talks to her father, he's still going, I can't believe you gave up bagels for mint jelly. Like, that's the only thing that's relevant about her Americanism or her New Yorker, you know, ness is that, like, she comes from New York where they're working class and they run a diner and they eat bagels. And this is the only thing that's relevant about her personality, not about, like, that she was trying to be a hard-hitting reporter and was really, like, you know, really dedicated to her career and to climbing the ladder, not that she's a really kind person who enjoys being in a position where she can try to do good for others, not that she, you know, but what's important is she's an American, specifically she's a New Yorker, and we're going to have the most sort of like homegrown small town elements of New York be what define her, right? Like, you miss your father's diner and you talk like this and you, you know, and they keep like hammering that home. You know, she, her friend shows up and she's like, I don't know, don't you want to go back to New York instead of being here at the castle? Which, like, no, did you hear yourself? You know, and then with the Penguins and the Aldovians, everything is about the fact that they're Penguin or they are Aldovian. Everything is about the fact that they're royal. They constantly put the word royal in front of things. Like, they invite everyone to the royal baby shower.
Okay, can we pause really, really quickly to talk about how I actually gasped at how tacky the royal baby shower was? Oh my God.
It's so terrible. It was like the world's worst balloon arches everywhere. And at a time when theoretically no one could get through the road. So I was like, did they just like have this stuff in the castle ready to go? So terrible. And considering that they had upped their game with the Christmas decorations to look less shitty than in the past two movies, I was like, why? Why is the front hall of the castle, which is where they have the baby shower, like literally the front entranceway, not in like a ballroom, just covered in like Party City terrible decorations?
I know. And it's so sad because in earlier scenes, like when they had been in that like whatever throne room where they kept the treaty, I was actually pretty impressed with what the production design team did there because it was pretty good considering they basically have these like shoestring budgets. But that party, you guys, like, I know these movies are designed for people who will never go to a five-star, like, luxury event in their life, but not to brag, I have been to some very fancy-ass parties, some very fancy-ass places, like embassies and, you know, performing arts centers, parties that involve top politicians, our version of royalty, right? It ain't like this. They don't have balloons, let me tell you. Balloons are not involved.
I'm thinking of when we all went to New Year's at the Kennedy Center and you snuck us in.
That was so fun. That had balloons, but that was because that was for the peons. That was for us plebeians.
Right. That wasn't even like a particularly fancy party, but the decorations were so much classier than this shit. Yeah, it's like, it's just so wild. Their concept, they're continually trying to dumb things down for what clearly is a middle America audience. And I don't say that to be rude to anyone or any place that defines himself as middle America. I'm talking from a TV professional standpoint. That is the demographic that I can promise you these producers were aiming for, right? Like in their meetings, in their production meetings, I guarantee you they were like, we have to make this so that middle-aged, middle America moms will find it relatable, even though it's about a New Yorker who moved to a castle in Europe. And so they continually dumb it down. They have these like tacky ass decorations for the baby shower. They're really concerned about them having a baby shower, which I feel like is just like not a thing you need so much when you're a queen, because you probably don't need people to like buy you extra diapers.
Usually no.
I would think, I mean, I don't know how badly the Christmas Wars have, like, destroyed the royal coffers, but I feel like probably they can buy their own fucking cribs and like, baby bounce seats. But yeah, and they continually want to, like, remind you that Amber comes from humble beginnings, right? Like, it's so important to them that her father is a diner owner and, like, talks sort of gruff and says the wrong thing and embarrasses everyone. And it's important to remind you that, like, you know, I used to be a journalist and I used to run a blog and, you know, right? Like, they want her to be homey and middle class and relatable and, you know, and not elite in any way, despite it being about a character who's an actual queen. It's really wild to me. And it really, I feel like there's something fascinating happening there about what that fantasy is, or that perceived female fantasy is, that they're trying to fulfill with these movies.
Well, and it extends to the whole Aldovian monarchy too, doesn't it? That it's like this, it is, for lack of a better word, a basic with a capital B monarchy, right? It's like what you imagine a monarchy to be if you built it on the kind of budget where, and I say this as a person who's on this kind of budget, where you're buying stuff from the sales rack at TJ Maxx. And in some ways, that's kind of a beautiful thing, right? To say that, like, look, I'm going to offer you a fantasy that's achievable, that maybe looks a little bit more like your world. But is it a little bit disjointed and strange? Yeah. Does it a little bit undercut how absolutely unequal the entire idea of a monarchy is to begin with? Yeah. Like, seeing the king put together a crib with the other king was the most absurd thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, are you kidding me? Do you not think that these people have artisans working day and night for slave wages to build these people the dream crib?
No. They got a crib from IKEA, Janelle. Obviously, they got a crib from IKEA with confusing instructions written in Swedish like everyone else.
What in what? But see, that's the thing where I think it's insidious, right? It's like, on the one hand, I think, like, okay, this is nice. Offer people a fantasy that feels achievable to them that is still sort of has these fantastical elements. Lovely. Great. But on the other side, it does sort of feel like, well, rich people, they're just like us. They're not just like us. Jeff Bezos just was in space. Okay?
For like fucking a minute and a half.
Space.
But also at the same time, this still manages to have that sort of elitist hatred of the elite, right? Like, he continually, the king continually says things like, well, we didn't learn that when I was at boarding school. Well, our favorite game when I was at boarding school. Like, they want you to remember that he's a rich prince and he went to boarding school. I don't remember what the actual line was, but there was some line where he referred to something he learned in, like, high school. But he said, that's what we learned about in boarding school. And his use of the word boarding there was so forced. I was like, no one would have felt the need to remind you it was at a boarding school in the context of what he's saying right now. You would have just said in school, like, or from my teachers or whatever. But they were like, just as they constantly have to remind you that Amber's from New York and is relatable, they have to constantly be like, and look at these weird rich people, right? Like, there's, it's so strange in that they're trying to make wealth and royalty achievable and still other it.
It's a very American mentality, isn't it? It's very much that American dream mentality where it's like, I am a temporarily embarrassed millionaire. I am not of the elite, but I am also not of the working class either. You know, right. it's like you said, it's a very distinctly middle class perspective to have.
Absolutely. And that sort of that temporarily embarrassed millionaire mentality, I think, works so well in the context of these princess movies because, like you say, we're not royalty and you can hate the royalty, right? Like, you can be like, oh, the aristocracy, they didn't earn this. They suck. But if I reach their level of wealth or of power, I earned it. And so even though at that point I will be equivalent to them, I will be better because I don't suck.
That level of power would not change me, but...
Right. I would still be a journalist. I would still wear my Converses. I would still want to raise my baby to be a feminist. unlike those dumb royals who are so old-fashioned and backwards and also have so much money they don't know what to do with, but I also deserve to have that kind of money because I would know what to do with it.
It makes me think a lot about this alternate history and these politics that are being put forward alongside it at the same time, right? That, like, in a weird way, involving Penglia and just ignoring the fact that Penglia was clearly in some ways culturally dominated by Aldovia, since they speak a common language, one. Mm-hmm. They have a common religious practice, two. And three, they sort of have this political treaty. It undermines the idea in the subtext that power would not change you, that power would not make you into a dominator, that power would not render you certainly not of the people, right? Like, mm-hmm. you would be a power player. You would be a chess piece in this, like, very old chess match. I don't know. There's a lot going on there. And also, I kind of wonder, like, is this Aldovian propaganda, this movie? Probably. Mm. Aldovia is not real, but let's pretend that it is.
No, I mean, it definitely exists in a world where the Black Sea still has livable land instead of just ocean. So I think it's real, just in an alternate universe.
Also, again, I have to admit that it is so fucking funny to me that this movie is called Christmas Prince, a Royal Baby, and we have literally talked about baby shit twice.
The closest we've gotten is talking about the tacky decorations at the baby shower and the two kings putting together the crib, which, by the way, am I the only one who's convinced that those two kings are fucking?
They are. Please, someone.
So they literally, the first time that the two kings talk, the king of Penglia is like, ah, finally I'm meeting the playboy king of Aldovia. And he's like, I'm not a playboy anymore. So first of all, weird introduction after you've just met his wife.
I bet okay. They had some fun times at the Savoy, you know
and
what I
then,
mean?
And then they're at the baby shower and the women are like giggling over a crocheted hat because women. And the two of them walk over and they literally say, ah, yes, happy wife, happy life. Then they give each other a look. Then the king of Aldovia is like, I need your help with something. And the two of them give each other another look and then walk away. And then we find out they went to go build the crib together. No way. The two of them definitely were like, keep your wife happy so you can go sleep with your boyfriend, right? Like, that's what that conversation was.
Wow, Eliza, you're blowing my mind right now because of how right you are. And this is really putting forward to me that what I want is a Christmas Prince prequel where we get all of the hot and heavy political intrigue of the real history between Penglia and Aldovia, and it's all worked out through the deep sexual connection between these two kings. Like, how hot does that sound when they're like young bucks and they're spending the summer together in the English countryside at their boarding school for young royals?
That's why he keeps mentioning boarding school. It's another like hint that he's giving the other king where he's like, ask me about boarding school.
Oh my god, wait. Kate Kearns, friend of the show, Kate Kearns, you write romance novels. This is, please write this. I know it's not your style to do like a, whatever the male equivalent of a bodice ripper is, but please. A shirt ripper? What would you
pants
call it,
ripper.
Eliza?
You gotta rip pants. You gotta rip the, what's an old word for pants?
Pantaloon, a pantaloon ripper.
See, there's so many better stories than the ones they choose to tell in these movies. And I'm talking about stories in these movies. There are better stories in this movie than the one they told.
Well, that's the solace we'll take from it, is that these movies will literally pull your soul out from your eyeballs, but they will inspire generations of screenwriters to come to write weirder and more interesting things, we hope.
Hopefully, those things will be written by writers who, unlike the writers of this movie, have ever played a board game.
That would be nice, because what was that, Eliza?
Yeah, they have a, and this is the exact quote, classic Aldovian Christmas game. So again, what a weird Christmas-based society they live in, that there's more than one Aldovian Christmas game, but this one's a classic. And it's basically, it's like 3D chess in that there's like this 3D board, but it's shaped like a Christmas tree. And then there's little pieces that you put on the board and you try to get to the top. And the way you get to put pieces on the board is by answering questions about Aldovian political history. So that Christmas game is also clearly propaganda. But the weirdest part is that the Penglians are able to effectively play the game.
Yeah.
like, they're asking them all these weird specific questions about Aldovian Christmas history, and the Pangolians almost win the game.
This is because the Pangolians, I am convinced, are not Christmas dictators, but they are subject to this Christmas dictatorship. Mm-hmm. That's the terms of the treaty. We never learned what the terms of the treaty are, but I think that's what they are. No, it's like, you join our Christmas dictatorship or you perish. That's it.
Because, I mean, he's literally like, ah, a classic Aldovian children's Christmas game. And the Pangolians are like, oh, yes, we used to love to play this as kids. Which would be like if some French kids and some German, or like some French people and some German people were hanging out, and the Germans were like, oh yeah, we have this really classic German game that like every kid in Germany plays as a kid. And the French kids were like, yeah, we haven't played that since we were really little. Like, why would you have played it? It's German. Like, why? It clearly Aldovia controls Panglia and has for hundreds of years. And it's time for the Pangolians to revolt.
But Eliza, we have never been at war with Panglia. We have always been at war with Panglia.
It all comes back to George Orwell.
Always, it always does. Well, this is the time every week where we take a break to thank our patrons on Patreon, and specifically our gorgeous, deeply magical romantic leads. They are Bob, Esther, Ian Trey, and lovely, lovely Melissa. Thank you so much.
If you want to become a patron as well, you can go to patreon.com/romcomkilljoys. And for as little as $1 a month, that's just $12 a year, you can help to support us and keep this podcast going, as well as gain access to some fun behind-the-scenes stuff and extra content. You can also get some extra content by liking us on Facebook and Instagram. And you can go there to share your thoughts on the complicated, complicated political dynamics of Aldovia and Panglia. Okay. Well, there was a lot to talk about this week. So I feel like... Oh, you all right?
Yep. I was just reacting to how much there was to talk about. It was this shocking amount of material, yeah.
So I feel like that's a lot of material to inspire some antidotes. Janelle, what do you suggest for the week?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, I was watching these films, and I was thinking, you know what? When I want a summertime anachronistic film about a curse, do I really want to watch a Christmas movie? No. I want to watch a horror movie. So my antidote for this this film is the very well fleshed out, very well thought out, very good lore building Fear Street series, which recently premiered on Netflix. It's a three-part series, Fear Street 1994, Fear Street 1978, and Fear Street 1666. So these films chronicle the travails of a community that is comprised of two towns, Sunnyvale and Sunnyside, and Shadyside, rather. And Shadyside has this horrible thing that happens where they're constantly getting people murdered. What a coincidence! And people attribute it to the curse of a witch. I don't want to spoil it any further than that, because the series unfolds really beautifully in the way that it explains its lore, and there's a wonderful twist towards the end that places everything in a completely new light and really will make you think about not only the films, but also our current political situation in a new way. So I feel like it's a very appropriate antidote for this this film. It's surprisingly political. It is totally anachronistic for July, and there's a lot of blood. So I loved it. That's the Fear Street series on Netflix. What do you have, Eliza?
Well, so I was thinking about love stories about royalty and about connections between multiple royal families, multiple kingdoms, and what would be a better version of that story. And I thought of the absolutely wonderful and beautiful Bollywood epic Jodha Akbar.
Ooh.
Which is... if you've got 5 hours to put aside some time, go watch it. It's a long movie, but it is unbelievably beautiful. It is based on a true story. Obviously, it's a fictionalized version of it, but about a marriage that happened between two royals on the Indian Peninsula in the 1600s, I want to say. Might be a little off on that number, but somewhere around there. One is from the Hindu nation, one is from the... Islamic nation at the time, and so it is a peace treaty marriage, but of course it's a Bollywood epic, so it follows them, you know, being forced into this political marriage, falling in love, falling out of love. There are twists and turns. It's filmed unbelievably beautifully. The two leads are unbelievably beautiful. The music's phenomenal. And it is definitely a way better princess story than anything we've watched this month.
That sounds amazing. I think that is an absolutely pitch perfect antidote, and I cannot praise you enough for it. Brilliant.
Why, thank you. Yeah, I think I might go watch that right after this and cleanse my palate.
And I'm going to go back and watch Fear Street again to watch some teenagers scream and meet their gruesome ends. So we're going to go honestly, in very different directions, but it's
that also sounds great, though. If only you could just sort of Photoshop Amber's face onto the screaming teenagers.
Don't tempt me. I'll do it.
Well, Janelle, we got through it. We've got one more week in the month, but we are done with our princess Christmas movies. We are just going to do a good Christmas movie next week. So definitely tune in to get a palate cleanser. And we're now done with the Christmas Prince saga.
God, thank God. I'm free.
Until I'm finally free. Their Prexit happens.
No. Don't say it, Eliza. But hey, until then, we are free. We have peace.
We are free.
There's peace in Panglia.
Theoretically. All right, bye everyone.
Bye!
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time.
Instead of breaking up, it starts and kissing and making